one page of notes last night on your email somewhere you can find it, which is the, I should say, prettied up or perhaps correct version of the Brillouin zone for the triangular lattice calculation. It would be interesting to compare the picture that I sent you to the picture which was on the blackboard here, but there, I think there are some similarities. So I feel that today the best thing for us to do as we move on this motion of periodic potential is to go directly to electron energy bands. And then I think that will sort of fill in a gap that will make it easier to discuss how things are working. So that's what I'd like to start with. And I think I've already explained that the idea here is that this is this sort of mean field or one electron picture of the electronic system, that it's as if each electron moves in the potential of the crystal and all the other electrons that are there, so that you get these, but you get these one electron states, which are have a relation, those states have some relationship between the energy and the wave vector in the sense that we'll discuss now. Okay, so I'm going to start with the really simplest situation, is that so in free space, we have these wave functions that we can label with the wave vector. And there is kinetic energy associated with this motion. And for finite volume and periodic boundary conditions, these wave vectors K are quantized in the way that we've said. And so, okay, so now, for everything that we're going to discuss, let's just stick to one dimension because the pictures are a lot easier to draw, and the principles are easily generalized to higher dimension. So this is our E of K for particle in free space. Now, imagine that we turn on a periodic potential that comes from the crystal lattice. And we turn it on in a way that it's extremely small. And in fact, you can say that it's essentially zero. But we know that if we have a periodic lattice, then, or if we have a periodic potential, we can describe it in terms of these reciprocal lattice vectors. Q, which in one dimension would be 2 pi over the lattice constant. And so we can label on this picture where the Qs are, or in fact, let me just draw in Q over 2 and minus Q over 2. Like that. Now, I've labeled the states and the energies this way, but I could actually relabel them in a slightly different way. I'm trying to get this picture, right? I could take this branch here and translate it by Q over to here, like this, and translate this branch by minus Q over to here. So that it would look like this. And instead of labeling all of my states by K, these guys will be labeled by K. These guys will obey a new dispersion relation, which we'll call epsilon Q K, which is equal to H bar squared Okay. So basically, this dispersion relation here is intended to be exactly, make it a little neater, this dispersion relation here translated. Okay. And the wave function, if you like, you could write it as e to the ik plus e to the ik dot r plus e to the iq dot r. So this branch here is E, if I've done this right, QK, and this branch here is epsilon minus QK, if I've done that correctly. And all this is really a relabeling. Instead of saying that a particle has wave vector K, you do it modulo a reciprocal lattice vector, and pull it back into what is the first Brouwer zone. Okay? But I haven't done really anything except a relabeling of the states. The wave functions physically look the same. The energies take on the same spectrum of values. Now, why is this useful? Okay? So this is useful if we consider what the actual effect is of the periodic potential. So the periodic potential looks like this, or it's the one-dimensional general case that we're interested in. So this is summed over reciprocal lattice vectors. And what is the effect of the periodic potential? Okay? The effect of the periodic potential, if we start off with no potential and just free particle states, the periodic potential will have matrix elements between states K and K plus Q. It will scatter or change the momentum. It's like a diffraction process, okay, where the particle or wave, if you like, which is traveling along with wave vector k, can be diffracted into a state k plus q or k minus q. It could be if that were resonant. It isn't, actually, okay, typically. Okay. But the point is this scatters . So the question that we want to ask is, what happens to these states as we gradually turn on this periodic potential? And we want to address that in a kind of a perturbation theory type language or way of thinking. Okay. And so, for instance, in the presence of this potential, or the one-dimensional version of this, yeah.
What's the difference between the state with k and k plus q is v cubed?
Okay, so you have your Hamiltonian, which is just kinetic energy, and you have your states, which are kinetic energy states. That's this. And then you add a potential v. Okay? Start out with your states for plane wave states, or states of constant momentum, states of a given momentum, because your system is translationally invariant. Okay? You then put on a crystal potential which is periodic, but which completely breaks translational symmetry. So now all of a sudden, your plane wave states, or free particle states, are no longer eigenstates of this Hamiltonian. The effect of this perturbation is to mix up those states to generate new eigenstates. And the question is, what will those be? Okay. And so you can intuit or hand wave what they will be from the point of view of perturbation theory, which is what I'll do next. But is that clearer then? OK. So now we're going to say, OK, what happens to these states when we mix them up with this crystal potential, which has broken translational symmetry? Okay, so let's just do second order perturbation theory to say, okay, let's look at a state down here, okay, and say, what is the effect of the periodic potential? Well, in second order perturbation theory, there will be a matrix element between this state here at k, and then you have to go q up here. That's mediated by v of q. Okay, these two states are mixed in second order perturbation theory, as are two states over here. And so then what second order perturbation theory tells you is that this state's going to be moved down. Okay? That's just the way what happens to the lowest energy states in second order perturbation theory. It's only interacting with states at higher energy. You can say something a little bit slightly more interesting. This is actually the boring case down here. But you can say something slightly more interesting, which is that as you move, say, off to the right here, the state at k plus q is up at higher energy, but the state at k minus q is down at lower energy. And so I believe, if I've done this right, that the spectrum will be distorted somewhat like this, say. That as you move out away from k equals 0, the states will be pushed down a little bit more than the one right at k equals 0. I think that's right. If it isn't, it would, well, it has to be. So, you know, the curvature of the energy versus moment of wave vector is the inverse effective mass, is the inverse mass. So it's as if the particle will become slightly more massive in second order perturbation theory because these states are pushed down in as you move away from the origin more. Actually, the state at the origin is pushed down too. I just haven't drawn that. Yeah. Okay.
Why did you draw those lines?
Why did I draw which lines?
The lines through the points through the center.
These guys?
Yes.
Okay, so I'm basically relabeling my energy states. so that I can plot them all as being between in the first Brouwer zone. Okay. I can do that as long as I keep track of where they came from. So, like, for instance, this guy was translated by plus Q. I may have my signs wrong here. This guy came from... Yeah, no, this guy was at plus Q, and this guy was at minus Q. So these energies here, when I've shifted them into the first Brouwer zone and labeled them with a K, I have to remember the fact of where they came from. So that's why they're up here. Does that make sense? You getting that?
But do those lines connect them to the original points on the graph? So
this here should be identical to this here, only translated by Q. Yeah.
So at the end of the Brouwer zone, they should reflect back again.
If you keep going, you'll do more of
like
this.
Higher
yeah.
And higher.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it quickly becomes more complicated, but I thought we should just stick to the lowest ones.
Okay. So, sorry.
Yeah.
It's unclear to me, this potential doesn't look periodic, right?
Which potential? This?
That thing, the energy curve that we drew. So why can't we just shift them around?
The shift that I've done is just a relabeling. Okay? In other words, I can write, this is E of K out here. If I say I'm going to define a new K, which is restricted to the first Brouwer zone, I can write the energy in terms of that, as long as I remember that these states also carried a big Q. So they have a higher energy than these states here, which are just K squared over 2m.
Right.
Okay, and I can keep doing that with all the states. So I take this parabola, I can keep folding it back into this first Brouwer zone. As long as I keep track of where the states came from, I'll know what their energies are. Okay, so what I'm saying here is that the states that I write in the first Brouwer zone are labeled by a K vector, which goes between minus Q over 2 and plus Q over 2, plus a reciprocal lattice vector, which tells you, basically fills in the rest of the information about what their wavelength is or how rapidly they're oscillating in space. Okay, we getting there? No? It's just a different way of labeling the wave function and its energy. You can either label them by a wave vector that can be between minus infinity and plus infinity, or you can label them by a wave vector which is modulo Q plus how many Qs, you know, whether they were at Q or 2Q plus K or 3Q plus K and so forth. You can then label all the branches of, yeah, Michael.
People might be asking this, why would you want to do that? It's more complicated.
That's right. Okay.
The answer, as I understand it, is that with a periodic potential, so if it's free electrons, you can do it either way. It doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. But when you have a periodic potential, the particle that interacts with the periodic potential, its momentum can be changed by a lattice vector, a reciprocal lattice vector.
That's right.
So it's only the K that's in the first Brouwer zone that's actually conserved.
Right. And
so
in fact, if I...
It would be good to just get rid of all the Ks outside of the first Brouwer zone and put everything right into that zone.
And in fact, if I've done this right, okay, so if you just look at the parabola now and say, what does the periodic potential do? It connects a state over here to a state at plus Q. But when I move this back over here, it's actually connecting it to the state immediately above it.
Right.
Okay? So the bottom line is then that as a result of this construction, where I've mapped everything modulo Q into the first Brouwer zone, the effect of the periodic potential is that all of the energy states, all of the states whose energies lie at the same k in the Brouwer zone are connected or interact by the periodic potential. Okay? So that's the reason for doing this. It makes it's a complicated way of describing free particle motion, but it's a very convenient way of describing motion in the crystal lattice.
So given a certain k, we have this different energies.
Right. So here there's a state which has one energy, and here there's a state that has a different energy but the same k, and here there's another state that has a different energy and the same k.
And how do they interact? You said they interact with each other. Like
because this potential,
right. So do they
by construction, right. Has matrix elements between the ones that lie above each other.
So
in the Brouwer zone.
So they, when they get excited or they get relaxed, they jump from.
No, there's no particles here yet. There's no electrons. These are the states which might be empty or full. Okay? What this is, how this picture evolves is that you start out with zero potential and you turn it on. And as you turn it on, this picture will start to change in a way which is easily understood in using either non-degenerate or degenerate perturbation theory. Okay, and the net result of this will be what's called the band structure, because these lines will break up into separate bands.
So just to say the same thing again, one way to compute the energy spectrum in this non-trivial potential is you draw a vertical line on this plane that intersects some specific free particle space, and then you write a matrix. You can write the Hamiltonian as a matrix between those three particle states, and then you diagonalize the matrix.
Right. If you want to go back to why did we derive the these wave vectors in the Brouwer zone and the reciprocal lattice vectors and so forth, it's basically because these guys, these k's, are good quantum numbers. They're conserved quantities even in the presence of the crystalline potential. But there are many states that have the same k, and those are actually affected by the periodic potential. They mix together to form the... But this state here at a given k doesn't mix with a nearby state with a different k. It's only the ones that are right above, because they differ by a reciprocal lattice vector, and this potential scatters between those such states. Okay, so the question that we should address next is, when you turn on the periodic potential, what do these energies, how do they change, what do they look like? Okay, and maybe we need a clean picture for that. So let's draw it this way now. Just to remember what the unperturbed thing was, and then here's q over 2 and minus q over 2. And then, if I can do this right. This is supposed to be parallel to this, and this is supposed to be parallel to this. Okay. So the question is,
what happens to
I'm sorry, can you hear me?
First order perturbation theory, what happens?
You mean in the degenerate perturbation theory? Oh, what happens in...
Yeah, you talked just about second order perturbation theory. What about first order?
Let's see. This potential... Okay, so first order perturbation theory would be like this. K V of R K. That would give you a delta E K, right? Okay, but the point is that this potential changes. In other words, this is a, has e to the I q dot r's, and this is e to the I k dot r. And when you combine those two together, and then this is e to the minus I k dot r, you get zero, because it doesn't have any matrix element between states with the same k. So that's the first order perturbation is zero. Unless you have, well, you'll see. That's right. That's it. So the point is you can't scatter off the periodic potential and end up in the same state. Okay, so let's look at where things happen that are the most dramatic. And that is, if you like, the potential would scatter you between states like this in the free particle picture, the V of Q could connect a state over here to a state over here, where the significance of this is that the difference in energy between these two states is very small. And in fact, if you go from this state to this state, then you're talking about degenerate perturbation theory. Okay, so the point is that the periodic potential has the largest effect when it connects states whose energies are nearly equal. Now, at this point, you can do some algebra and diagonalize the okay, so what I should also say is that if you look at V of Q, you might ask yourself, well, what about V of minus Q? What does that do to this state? And that actually connects this state to a state up here, which is very far away in energy. So you could ignore that. Yeah.
So what is V of Q?
This is the Fourier component of the lattice potential, which connects two states whose wave vectors differ by Q, which in the reduced zone scheme corresponds to these two states. So I've taken you outside the Brown zone here, but in the reduced zone scheme, it's connecting these two. So the point is that degenerate or nearly degenerate perturbation theory is going to make these two levels repel each other. And in fact, if you look at the states which are degenerate here, they're going to split by an amount absolute VQ. So what does this band structure look like? Let me just draw the whole thing here. Or okay. So what happens is that these states, which were previously degenerate, are split by, I guess it's absolute VQ. These states, which were down here, are slightly perturbed by the perturbation. Now, as it turns out, exactly the same thing will happen up here. And if I get rid of this stuff outside the first Brouwer zone, just to you can start to see the emergence of bands, electron energy bands. Okay, there's the lowest one down here, which is separated by a gap from the next band, and then by another gap from the next band, and then this just goes on and on. Okay. And what about the wave functions? Well, these wave functions here were pretty much e to the ik dot r, where k was a small number, which fits in the Brillouin zone. So they'll have relatively long wavelength oscillations. These guys up here were all derived from wave functions that were q plus k. In other words, we're labeling k is in this region, but these have an extra fast oscillation due to the fact that there was an e to the iq dot r or x in them. So these look like much more rapidly oscillating functions and so forth as you go up. But however, particularly in this region, you have wave functions that are mixed, k and k plus q. So I guess one of the most dramatic features of the effect of the periodic potential is that all of a sudden there are energies which the electrons can't have. Okay, there are forbidden energies. Which are called energy gaps. And this is what accounts for properties that distinguish between insulators and metals. If the number of electrons that you have in your system is just the number that's required to fill all of these states, and then there's a gap to the next empty states, then these electrons are sort of rigidly bound. If you apply an infinitesimal perturbation in a metal, like an electric field, a weak electric field, you can cause a current to flow. But in this system here, because of this gap, an infinitesimal perturbation like an electric field will not do much of anything. It certainly will not generate a current. So the system where these states are filled, there's a gap, and these states are empty is an insulating system. Okay. So I haven't written any formulas. Here, you can calculate all these things. I guess we'll post my notes, which have that done. Okay. But more questions about this? Yeah.
Just really quickly
go back.
Go over the whole thing.
Yeah, let's go through the logic again. Okay. So so the point is that. In the wave function k, you can think of its quantum number as a label for the wave function. You can label your wave functions. And then they have a spatial dependence that's written in terms of that label, and they have an energy that depends on that quantum number. Okay? And so you can then show the relationship between the energy and the quantum number by drawing this curve.
Is k not the momentum?
I'm sorry, I'm missing.
K not the momentum.
It is if the problem that you're dealing with is particles moving in free space. Okay, that's exactly true. And we're looking at that space of states and their energies, and then we're going to use those as a basis for figuring out what happens if it's not free space, but it's in fact a crystal potential. Okay, so these, but that still are basis functions for solving this more complicated problem. Okay. So the first thing that we do is we relabel these states in a way which is going to be more appropriate to the case of a crystal. In the case of a crystal, you don't just have states with k between minus infinity and plus infinity, although you could. Have states which are labeled by a quantum number that goes between minus q over 2 and plus q over 2. But for each one of those quantum numbers, there are many states which are labeled by an additional quantum number that comes out of solving the problem with the periodic potential. Okay. So we simply map all of these free electron energies versus wave vector into this first Brouwer zone by translating them and remembering how much we translated them by. So in this case, for this branch here, this corresponds to the energies of states, free particle states, which were this region in K space. And as long as we keep track of that, that they were over here, we can calculate their energy correctly using a formula like this. This erased formula. Okay. So now we've arranged all of our energy eigenvalues and quantum numbers in such a way that they're basically modulo a reciprocal lattice vector. Then we turn on the periodic potential, and we know from, you know, Fourier theory or whatever it is, doing the integral, that the periodic potential scatters particle from state K to state K plus Q. In the original picture, that might have been like this. In the folded back picture, those are these vertical interactions between states at the same K. Okay. We then do, we then could just diagonalize some big matrix if you want. You could take your V of R for its, look at its Fourier components and write down a big matrix that says how things are connected. Or you can just argue in terms of perturbation theory how the matrix elements between different states will affect the energies of the states. So if the two, if matrix elements between states that are far apart in energy, you can calculate in the second order perturbation theory, they repel. For states that are nearly degenerate, like this and this, you're using degenerate perturbation theory, which basically means diagonalizing within the manifold of the two states, and you get these gaps. Yep.
So I'm trying to understand whether one can understand the energy gaps from a physical point of view rather than just invoking degenerate.
It is. Okay, so there is where your diffraction really occurs, because that's, it's elastic, if you like. You're connecting states that are at the same energy, and they're diffracted. Okay. So how does that turn into gaps?
You're not allowed to have.
Yeah. Well, no, I guess I have to think more about that. But the point is that you know exactly what happens when you do have two states at the same energy that are connected by off-diagonal perturbation, that one goes up, one goes down. Okay, so you can sort of see that's the only thing that can happen in here. Okay, how are we doing?
Can you explicitly show us, please, how you get the gaps?
Yeah. Okay, I can do that. So basically, what I was arguing was that the V of Q, there's one that connects this state here, is connected to a state that has very nearly the same energy, and it's also connected to a state that has rather different energy. So a reasonable approximation is to forget about that other state. That's just going to give you some additional small renormalization, and just work within the manifold of these two states. Okay, then your perturbation theory becomes a 2x2 matrix. Okay, so your Hamiltonian, if you like, I don't know what to call it here. Let's call it H of K. It's a 2x2 matrix that looks like this. I've done this. Oh, I guess I call it Q here. Well, let's call it Q. Uh, is connected to h bar squared over 2m minus q. Sorry, minus q over 2 plus q squared. So these are the two states that are connected, minus q over 2 plus a little bit, and plus q over 2 plus a little bit, and then folded back into the Brouwer zone. And then here we have VQ and V minus Q, which is just a complex conjugate of V of Q. So the energies that result from the perturbation of the potential, you can derive by solving this 2x2 thing. And I mean, you can work it out as well as I can, but it's something like this. Your secular equation is h bar squared over 2m, q over 2 plus q squared minus lambda times h bar squared over 2m, q over 2 minus q squared minus lambda minus vq squared equals 0. That's just the secular equation that corresponds to this 2x2. And when you multiply all those things out, you get that your eigenvalues are given by solving this equation. Oh, I see, yeah. I think there's a bracket here. Oh, no. I think I have it right in my notes, sorry. Okay, anyway, bottom line is that you get perturbed energies . So you look at this 2x2 matrix, which just has that one matrix element in it. You solve, write out the secular equation and solve the quadratic equation. And what you get looks like this. And what that's telling you is that when q goes to 0, then you have a gap. Then you're basically at the unperturbed energy. Okay, so this, if you're looking here or here, where in the free electron picture your energy would correspond to wave vector big Q over 2, so it'd be h bar squared big Q over 2 squared over 2m. So if you're looking right here, that corresponds to this little q being 0. You get the energy that you would have gotten plus or minus the absolute value of VQ of the potential. Yeah?
So is the matrix here the Hamilton restricted to the slip space that we're considering for separate?
Yeah, it's, well, this is degenerate perturbation theory, but anyway, yeah. It's restricted. Okay, so what we've said is that the potential scatters U between here and here, or if you like, between here and here. It also, what we've thrown away is the other thing that the potential does, which scatters U between here and, I guess, here. Okay, that's not going to have much of an effect. Okay? So basically, we've made an approximation that we're going to consider the effect of the scattering on states that were initially very close together in energy. And that's where, then, this is an exact solution within that subspace. Okay. Yeah, Catherine.
What is the first term there?
This h4 squared over 2m and this big Q times little q.
And all of that
squared. Right, yeah. Yeah. I hope I did my algebra. I mean, I had my last year's notes and I did it again this year and it came out in the same thing, so I hope it's right. Yeah, Michael.
Of course, this way more mathematical is we're talking about this. We think about integrating the Schrodinger equation over the periodic interval.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's right. Yeah, I mean, I've neglected.
That's helpful to some.
I don't know.
Maybe I should just say, if anyone would like to see a way more mathematical derivation of the bands, ask me after.
Yeah, but I mean, it's also presumably in all the condensed matter. By the way, we didn't put up our, did we put up our sheet about all books on condensed matter physics?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Yeah. So, sorry, what I've tried to do here is the hand-wavy version of this rather than the mathematical version of it to emphasize, well, hopefully to emphasize what's actually happening here. But, okay. So actually, I'm going to move away from nearly free electron theory. But let me just recapitulate. Actually, I had a few comments, I guess, that I wanted to make. One is just on in terms of energy scales, particularly for solids and metals, or insulators and metals, where this type of theory might apply. The energy scales here of these bands are electron volts. And I guess at perimeter, they don't advertise the fact that one electron volt is 11,605 degrees Kelvin. But the point is that it's a big number. So if you have bands that are 2 eV wide or 10 eV or gaps that are a few electron volts, and you're living at room temperature, those energy scales are enormous. And the idea that the temperature might be low, even though it feels fine in this room, is perfectly valid for these electronic systems, the ones that have the big bands. In fact, essentially all electronic systems.
Actually, it depends where you're sitting.
Now it doesn't. Good point.
I don't see where these parameters come in which give me a scale. Is it A?
It's M.
M and A.
M and A. Yeah, right. It's your lattice constant and your mass of your electron. Your mass is extremely light. Your lattice constants are the size of atoms, which is no accident. And that's what gives you these energy scales. Okay, so that's one thing. The other point, which I've already made, is that it matters greatly where the chemical potential sits in this band structure. In other words, how many states are filled, which states are filled and which states are empty. And it matters whether the chemical potential lies in a gap or in a region of states where there's a continuum of states. And these bands describe the dynamics of electrons in crystals. Okay, so just like p squared over 2m describes the dynamics of massive particles in free space, these funny-looking bands also describe the way that the electrons in these states move. So if you've got electrons down here, you might say that they move pretty much like free electrons. If you've got electrons up here, well, look, wow, there's an energy-momentum relationship that starts off quadratically that looks like a particle, but with a I guess, a much smaller mass, okay, because it's curving up quickly. Okay, and similarly, oh, and these guys here, now that's something. what does that mean? It's backwards. Okay, so if you have, we're not going to get into this, but if you have your chemical potential lying here, then you've got holes in that band. Okay, and the curvature of these states is going down. And it's all nice and stable. It's not like negative mass particles. So that's something I wanted to say about this. And let's just go on, because I think we have time to do one more small topic. Okay, so that's it for helium free electrons for the moment. So this is the opposite picture. Imagine that you put together your solid by putting together atoms, and each atom has a electron, say, in its highest atomic level. Okay? So that you put these guys together, and you say, well, what are the energies of the electrons in that crystal? And their energies are E naught they're whatever the energy of that electron is on that atom in free space. Okay? And then the question is, what happens to the energies of those electrons as you bring these atoms closer together? Now up here, the electron was in a wave function that looked like this. It was highly localized on the atom. And the next one was over here. And these two guys, to a first approximation, don't see each other. So they each have the same energy, which is that E naught. So the question then arises, what happens when you bring these things together? And there is a significant interaction between, or overlap, if you like, between the wave functions on neighboring atoms. So let's think about the spectrum, or let's think about the Hamiltonian. What's the Hamiltonian here? Let's say, it's the number of electrons on each atom times the energy of an electron on that atom. And the spectrum looks like this. It's n-fold degenerate. Okay, if you move an electron, put it on different atoms, you get the same energy. So what happens here? Okay. So what happens here is that because of the overlap of these wave functions, there is a finite probability that an electron will hop from this atom to this atom, and so forth. So you can write, add an additional term to your Hamiltonian. I'm forgetting about spin for the moment. Let's say that we have a one-dimensional chain the way I've drawn it. Uh, Is that right? You can hop to the left or you can hop to the right. Okay. So this is something that is connected to the overlap of the wave functions and the energy scale of the problem. And the size of this probability or amplitude for hopping from one site to the next depends on how close together the atoms are or how much the wave functions overlap. So if you imagine plotting the spectrum versus t, it would look something like that. So this is a massively degenerate problem. And then as you turn on a coupling between the different atoms or the different levels, they're split. Actually, if I do it versus t, I guess it should just be linear. Right, I was thinking of doing it versus distance, but probably it's just probably just linear then. Okay. So this is called the tight binding model. And I don't know if I want to do the algebra here. Yep. Sorry. Question. This, okay, so C dagger, say, puts an electron into this orbital, creates one, and C destroys it. They're fermionic, yeah, so anti-commutators. Zero and, oh, sorry, this has, it can be zero or one. So again, as Michael said, in the case of the nearly free electron model, there are much more mathematical ways of deriving this. And similarly, you can start from atomic wave functions and derive expressions for these parameters. It's somewhat unsatisfying, actually, doing it that way. So my feelings about the tight binding model is that the best thing to do is just write it down. You know exactly what it means. It says that you have localized states with a non-zero hopping probability or transitions from hopping from one to the next. And then treat that as your quantum mechanical model of how electrons move in atoms in a solid. I should say something more about this, though. So you can diagonalize this Hamiltonian by Fourier transform, and that's what I would have done if I had more time, but it's really simple to do. And if you do it, what you find is that if you define, we did this before, I think, CK 1 over root n sum over I ci e probably to the minus ik dot ri. If you Fourier transform these operators or write them in terms of plane wave linear combinations, what you get is sum over k epsilon of k C dagger K C K, where epsilon of K is E naught minus, in this case here, because we've done a one-dimensional problem where you can just hop to the left or to the right, 2T cos K.
So they'll be in a cosine bound. Okay? And the point, the reason why I wrote this down is because I wanted to mention the fact that what I've drawn here is the case of a single orbital and hopping between them. You can imagine that there are more than one orbital per atom. And so instead of having a single tight binding band that looks like this is minus 2t cos k, you can imagine having several orbitals. You can imagine that this is degenerate because, for instance, say you have d orbitals on an atom. Well, actually, that wouldn't be degenerate. Okay, so there's you can imagine that there is a whole set of bands in here, and you can construct that or model that by writing down this type of Hamiltonian where there's more than one orbital on each atom and where the hopping, say, might be anisotropic in different directions and so forth. There's a lot of modeling that you can do. In fact, one way of looking at tight binding theory is that people have elaborately developed methods for calculating the band structures of electrons in solid. There's enormous computer programs to do that. And you can do that, and you can get out a band structure, energy bands, and it can look very complicated and look like spaghetti, lots of bands. And then you can model that by a tight binding Hamiltonian, which just fits all of those things. And that's actually useful then for calculating properties of that system. So one way of thinking of tight binding theory is as a way of modeling the electronic properties of systems. The other way of thinking of tight binding, and that'll come up a lot in this course, is that it's a simple model Hamiltonian for electrons in a lattice, which you can then use as part of solving a more sophisticated or difficult problem. Okay, so maybe we should stop there and give Rob a chance.